A couple of days after I sent Micah the information about the trip, the phone rang. I was at my desk in the office, struggling through another difficult day of writing. And when I picked up the receiver, Micah began rattling on almost immediately. "This trip is amazing," he said. "Have you seen where we're going to be going? We're going to Easter Island in Cambodia. We're going to see the Taj Mahal. We're going to the Australian Outback." "I know," I said. "Doesn't it sound great?" "It's more than great. It's awesome. Did you see that we're going on a dog sled ride in Norway?" "Yeah, I know." "We'll ride elephants in India." "I know." "We're going to Africa. Africa, for God's sake." "I know." "This is going to be great." "So Christine said you could go?" "I told you I'm going." "I know, but is Christine okay with it?" "She's not exactly thrilled, but she okayed it. I mean, Africa, India, Cambodia, with my brother? What's she going to say?" She could have said no, I thought. They had two kids. Peyton was only a couple of months old. Allie was 9. And Micah was planning to leave for a month shortly after Peyton's first birthday. But like Kathy, I was certain that Christine understood that Micah needed to see me as much as I needed to see him, albeit for different reasons. As siblings, we'd come to depend on each other in times of crisis, a dependence that had grown only stronger as we aged. We'd supported each other through personal and emotional struggles. We'd lived each other's ups and downs. We'd learned a lot about ourselves by learning about each other. And while siblings by nature often are close, with Micah and me, it went a step further. The sound of his voice never failed to remind me of the childhood we'd shared, and his laughter inevitably resurrected distant memories, long-lost images unfurling without warning like flags on a breezy day. "Nick? Hello? You still there?" "Yeah, I'm here, just thinking." "About what, the trip?" "No," I said. "I was thinking about the adventures we had when we were little kids." "In Minnesota?" "No," I said. "In Los Angeles." "What made you think of that?" "I'm not exactly sure," I admitted. "Sometimes it just happens." In 1969, we moved from the cold winters of Minnesota to Inglewood, California. My dad had been accepted into the doctoral program at the University of Southern California, and we moved to what some might consider the projects. Smack dab in the center of Los Angeles, the community where we lived still smoldered with the angry memories of the Watts riots in 1965. We were one of only a few white families in the rundown apartment complex we called home, and our immediate neighbors included prostitutes, drug dealers, and gang members. It was a tiny place, 2 bedrooms, living room, and a kitchen. But I'm sure my mom viewed it as a vast improvement over her life in Minnesota, even though she still didn't have the support of family. For the first time in 2 years, she had neighbors to talk to, even if they were different from the folk she grew up with in Nebraska. It was also possible for her to walk to the store to buy groceries, or at least walk outside and see signs of human life. It's common for children to think of their parents reverentially, and as a child, I was no different. With dark brown eyes, dark hair, and milky skin, my mom seemed beautiful to me. Despite the harshness of our early life, I never remember her taking her frustrations out on us. She was one of those women who were born to be a mother, and she loved us unconditionally. In many ways, we were her life. She smiled more than anyone I've ever known. Hers weren't those fake smiles, the kind that seem forced and give you the creeps. Hers were genuine smiles that made you want to run into her arms, which were always held open for us. My dad, on the other hand, was still somewhat of a mystery to me. With sandy, reddish hair, he had freckles and was prone to sunburns. Among all of us, only he had an appreciation for music. He played the harmonica and the guitar, and he whistled compulsively when he was stressed, which he always seemed to be. Not that anyone could blame him. In Los Angeles, he settled into the same grueling routine that he had in Minnesota: classes, studying, and working evenings as a janitor and bartender in order to provide us with the basic necessities of life. Even then, he had to rely on both his and my mom's parents to help make ends meet. When he was around the house, he was often preoccupied to the point of appearing absent-minded. My most consistent memory of my father is of him sitting at the table, head bowed over a book. A true intellectual, he wasn't the kind of dad who liked to play catch or ride bikes or go hiking. But since we'd never experienced anything different, it didn't bother us. Instead, his purpose, to us kids anyway, was to be provider and disciplinarian. If we got out of hand, which we did with startling frequency, my mother would threaten us by saying she was going to inform our dad when he got home. I have no idea why the very notion terrified us so, since my dad was not abusive. But I suppose it's because we didn't really know him.